So today is lecture 26. It's the last of the... There's two more lectures left. This is the last, next to last, of the meta-methodology lectures, as I've been calling them, on the design activity of iteration. And the one on Wednesday will be the second half of our evaluation and sort of quality lecture, mostly about usability and downstream implications of usability. And things like SLA, service level agreements, as they fit into that whole operation and evaluation. I'm going to start today with reminding you about iteration and iterative methodologies, and then talk about the design of iteration. Again, this is something which you don't normally think about, but we're going to stand back and try to understand different possibilities about iteration, sort of the scope and the cycle time and exactly what you're trying to learn in each iteration, as a way to get a more broad and abstract view of a design process. But I'll revisit a lot of the work we talked about earlier about different kinds of design problems and design contexts because they have particular implications for the way iteration should be done. And we'll talk a lot about the chapter from the Outside In Software book on continuous stakeholder alignment. I'm going to postpone either till Wednesday or till infinity the discussion of the Fairley and Wiltshire paper on taxonomy of iteration, even though I think it's a wonderful little paper, we just may not get to it today. Now, iteration is something which, in many ways, is inherent in design because it's pretty unlikely that a project will never have to do any work over again. It's almost part of design is to sort of think about things more than once. In fact, it's almost more interesting to say when is iteration not going to happen, in the sense that what kind of design problems are those, or what stages of what kind of design problems are those in which you have to get it right the first time. And there's a very small number of these, I think, and it's worth thinking about where you have to get it right before you do something in the next step of your design process. Can anyone think of any of those? What characteristics or attributes define those kind of design problems that you have to get it right before you go off and do something? Any ideas? Yeah.
Maybe space missions.
Space missions. Like, if you put a man on the moon, you better make sure it will get there before you put the man on the rocket.
And there we send unmanned
probes. Yeah, so we'll do a lot of things. But the actual last time, first time you put the man in the capsule, it's going to be the first time you put the man in the capsule. So, there may be a lot of design iteration, but at some point, there's some things which can only be done once. You have to get it done the first time in sort of maybe the new environment that you can't get to any other way except for the output of your design. Some products need to have complete requirements or some set of requirements satisfied before you can release it to the world. When would that be the case? What kind of situations are there where you have to do some set of functionality before you can release a product or service? Yeah, when there's laws, there could be laws or regulations or sort of bare basic functionality, you have to get it. It's kind of hard to imagine putting a car out in the market without brakes. You know, you can put software out that has pretty alpha functionality, but somehow you have to have a steering wheel and brakes and a few other things, turn signals. Things have to have in place because the laws may specify some minimum functionality. Yeah.
Pharmaceutical.
A lot of testing for drugs. I mean, there are some situations where designs have to be more or less complete. You can't say, well, if the marketplace test it. Okay? But I think those are the exceptions that prove the rule. The iteration really is pretty pervasive as a design technique. And the idea is that you want to get feedback from some important constituent, customer, or stakeholder, or whatever, because that may be the best way, the most efficient way to learn. Some things are just easier to test that way than trying to get them right in the lab or wherever you're doing your design. Now, iterations is most often described as a characteristic of design methodology, but I'm going to take a step back and treat it as a more broad concept because I'm going to show how it applies at different parts of a design methodology or different kind of levels of abstraction in a design methodology. Again, this is trying to give you a broader view of this stuff. But again, I'm going to go back to the earliest lectures. We had in the lecture on design techniques, we talked about a number of different ways of thinking about design, whether it's sequential or iterative and artifact-centered or activity-centered and so on. I mean, the basic idea of iteration is that we're going to inevitably do some activities, revisit previous work and analysis, and that's a good thing. Okay? Because the goal is to sort of just get through each activity to the extent that you can move on to the next step. You're reducing enough risk to get to the next step. And we've seen lots of examples of that. I want to make the point that each of these examples shows you a different aspect of what iteration might mean. One that you might have seen if you've studied any software engineering in a formal way is this one. It's a classic picture of software engineering. It's the spiral methodology of Barry Boehm. Some of you are shaking your hands because this is like motherhood God and the Ten Commandments of software engineering, that you want to have this spiral approach to software development. You see how it goes from these interior activities like getting the requirements, and as you spin around, you do progressive refinement. There's two things which are fundamentally wrong about this picture, though, in my book. Anyone have an idea as to what I don't like about this picture? Two things. One of them has to do with this little arrow of progress that says that everything you do kind of somehow is making progress. And any of us who've ever built anything know that at times you don't make progress. Sometimes you're undoing things, or you're fixing things that broke. And, you know, that this idea that everything you do is a step in the positive direction, I think is a little bit mischaracterizing what goes on in design activity. Second thing is that this picture, I think, shows that all the phases are equally sized and that they remain the same size at each cycle around the block. And that also is right, because the different steps in the design, you'll have different amounts of activities of things like, you know, design and test and evaluate. Yes? I'm sorry, I can't... That's right. That essentially is the evaluation cycle, saying when you've done something, you sort of say, what did we learn? What should we learn the next time? And what's the most important thing to resolve next? Again, that's happening continuously. That's why, again, this picture, as many of these pictures, really comes down to the granularity. I mean, in some sense, you can either say everything is iterative or everything is sequential, depending on how you think of the granularity of the activity. Now, another classic area in which we have iteration is the whole area of Agile, which in some sense was the successor to this picture, because this picture said, these boxes are too big. Let's make smaller boxes in software development, smaller slices. And these really have become very popular in the last decade or so, especially if we have smaller teams with more specialized development projects. And they really go out of their way to deprecate anything which looks like upfront investment and requirements and scoping, and the idea being that you really want to try very rapid coding cycles and testing to incrementally develop the software. Now, maybe I'm not characterizing that fairly. I tend to be a bit of an anti-agile person, because I come from the other tradition. I come from this tradition for sure, maybe even a more waterfallish tradition in software engineering. But I think that it's, with the exception of a complete sort of model-driven architecture, where you really want to have a design and push a big red button to generate code, it's almost always the amount of iteration, which comes down to how much. The agile iteration, as you saw in the Fairley and Wiltshire paper, they drew some nice pictures of it, and I want to reproduce some of them here. I like this picture because it really has... This shows that every cycle in an agile iteration is supposed to have requirements activities where, you systematize what you're going to do that cycle. So it's not just code away till it stops complaining. It's really think about what the new requirements are for this cycle. And finally, it has the customer in every one of the cycles. Now, I suspect that that's probably more true in this picture than it is in practice. I mean, people I know that have done Agile often, they put two programs in the corner and they go around a lot of cycles And I don't think a customer shows up very often, but any of these have done a lot of agile development in a company? Do you have customer needs in every cycle? An internal customer. So, okay, so again, there's, tell me this again, there's sort of the mythology around this methodology, and then there's the actuality around this methodology. But again, this idea that at every cycle you have this idea of incremental verification as you go around each cycle is a really important concept. And it comes down to what is the granularity of that cycle. Because this picture could look like this picture if we had a very large cycle time. It's just a question of what are you trying to accomplish on each cycle around the coding block. We've seen this picture several times this semester. It's the IBM Global Services methodology. And of course, this is inherently iterative. We have we want to learn both within each the design cycle here to build and do this several times. But we also want to have the larger cycle of release cycles. And again, that's a question of granularity. How much do you want to package as one release? That could be every 18 months, or it could be every day if you're in a software as a service mode where you want to make some very small modification every day to your hosted service. So again, it's clearly a question of point of view. And this picture, again, is decomposed further into this picture, which we've seen several times, where you have prototyping as an inherent part of that methodology. But again, as you remember from last week, prototyping can have multiple iterations. We talked last week about the example of the virtual library shelf, where I showed you that Jonathan Breitbart and Devin Blong had four distinct prototyping phases for the user interface to their virtual bookshelf before they built any real code. And so again, it's iteration within iteration in that methodology. This is the document engineering snake, which we used to call this in document engineering, the methodology of document engineering. And maybe it's pretty obvious by the shape of the snake that there's iteration here. What's going on here is that we start with observation in the physical world, that's the right column of this chart, implementation level analysis, and then we spiral through both different levels of abstraction and different levels of granularity of the world we're trying to build in order to come up with a solution that will work. So we start off by analyzing the situation fairly abstractly, the context of use and the high-level business pattern. Is this going to be a supply chain or a market or that kind of thing? Build the order or whatever it is. Then we use that to go back to the world, to look at the world with a set of expectations about what kind of documents and processes we should find. We then deconstruct those by moving back abstractly toward information models, which we then move back to the world to re-implement in a more robust and standard way. So this is iteration in both abstraction and granularity. And so I hope this very quick survey has helped you see that we have to answer some questions. We talk, what are we going to iterate? Is a first-class question in our methodology of design. We need to ask ourselves, where in the project should we apply iterative methods? What are we going to do each time we do an iteration? What are the processes in each iteration? What's the cycle time? That is, how long should each iteration take? And the meta model for feedback, which I'll unpack in a minute. But what it really means is, how do we expect to learn from each iteration? We need to answer all four of those questions if we're going to be systematic designers. Before I move on, I want to make the point that this is the sort of forward point of the Fairlane and Wilshire, that again, it's easy to imagine iteration implies incremental progress, progressive refinement, sort of onward and upward. And it is always possible that what you do during an iteration is fix something which broke on a previous cycle. Maybe the one you just finished, the one that you didn't discover for a while, but something which was caused by a previous iteration. And so you need to expect that some iteration will not be onward and upward, but it will be remedial or rework. And that's the point of the Fairlie Mitchell paper, that there's sort of, some of that is a good thing, and some of it is a bad thing, and they want to help us understand the taxonomy of iterative rework. Let me begin with this first big question about the scope of iteration. Something that I made up, and I want to sort of see if it works for you. But again, I want to, thinking abstractly about iteration, you know, it's easy if you're an engineer, software programmer, developer, to think, well, iteration is this thing at the agile level where it's two people in a cubicle and they're working iteratively. But that's only at the very lowest level, what I might call activity level iteration. That's where there's iteration within a very narrowly defined activity of the design process. We also can look at iteration as a methodology level design decision. That is, you know, what is the level, what kind of process method, project methodology is the project using? Are we gonna essentially have an overall iterative philosophy? I mean, like in something like the spiral methodology of document engineering. Or we're going to use iteration at a much level, at a project management or product management level, saying this is something we're doing as part of the way we do business. So we're going to think about having a product line which releases products over a very, very long period of time. We could be planning the next five products as we ship the first one. It could be at the heart of our decision to build a customer-centered organization that gets feedback effectively. And this is the scope of which Chapter 5 in OISD is written about, how to ensure continuous alignment with stakeholders. Now this is a chapter that I debated when I put this course together, having early in the semester, because in some ways you say, maybe iteration is something you want to look forward at as you go into your project and see it and recognize that some things will have to be done in an incremental or sort of iterative manner. But after the first time through this course 2 years ago, or the precursor of this course, I realized that this is a topic which is a little easier to appreciate in retrospect, for the next time. So I know that Ayush will never again look at a project plan the way he did after this semester, because he's had definitely problems with continuous alignment with stakeholders. I mean, they had a partner which flipped, kept going between being a partner and an adversary, as far as I can tell, in your project, and it wasn't clear which side he was on. And I think that having that a project plan in which, is that a fair characterization? And I know that some of you kept thinking, who are our customers that keep changing? I mean, that was certainly the case in your project, in that where it was, I mean, every time I read your wiki, it would be a different project. It was almost like, you know, when will the real project stand up, kind of thing. And again, so that this idea of who are you trying to achieve and maintain alignment with some set of stakeholders in your project is a major activity of the project. And if you don't expect it to happen, then it may not happen, because your project will be unraveling while you're trying to do some activity in your project. So again, this is a lecture which I hope makes more sense in retrospect, so that the next time you go to a project, you'll be aware of this and you'll kind of plan to have this, as opposed to just, but I don't think I could have warned you enough. You have to really live it. And many of you have done that. Remember this picture from about second lecture of the first lecture of class? When I was trying to frame my philosophy about this class, that I was going to basically not spend any time at all, if I could avoid it, in this part of the design space where you said you can do anything you want as long as you can do it in one semester. Essentially, no constraints, but no reflective time. And I want to spend more time over here. This is the fun stuff where you're really doing new product development with no constraints, a lot of time. You don't learn as much there, I think, as you do when you're over here, where you've got to deal with existing people, existing systems, existing stuff in the real world, maybe even some adversarial dimensions of your project. And this actually will shape the nature of iteration in your project, as again many have realized. We can imagine, and this is almost the caricature of design breakthroughs, that you're sitting in the bathtub and you go, "Eureka! I figured this thing out." Where you have this kind of flash of insight, and all of a sudden the design is in front of you. That really doesn't happen very much in practice. most design is going to be iterative, but it's not equally iterative in these different design contexts. Again, if you think about the legacy situation, the starting point is pretty well defined. It's like, we're going to maintain this thing or evolve this thing or integrate something else with this thing, existing system. And so there are a lot of constraints on where you can start. You start with the existing thing, kind of by definition. And so the design questions revolve more around can we try to build this thing, or should we try to build this thing, rather than what should we do? And the only feasible approach is to build on what you got. So it's an iterative approach that are almost inherent in legacy land. In less constrained context, like on the left side of this diagram, in R&D or new product development, or in the fake project context where you do it in one semester, in some sense, a problem is, where should I start? Now, that's the fun aspect of the R&D that says, what can we do? What can we do with the next product line for Apple? And it's, in some sense, exploring the design space, because you have no constraints, is a really important part of the overall learning experience and business model of the company. That may be your distinctive competency, being able to carve up a big design space into a manageable piece. It's really not worth the substance. The essence of that left side of the diagram is that it's hard to pin things down because there's so few constraints. But again, that's made it sort of interesting to me. I mean, some of you know that I'm on the third floor next to Kimiko Ryokai's office, and it's sort of been almost amusing this semester to watch the stream of students come up there trying to figure out what their project is going to be about. And it seems like some of you have spent half the semester figuring out what your project is going to be about in that class because it's so open-ended. So it's knowing where to start and asking questions about what are the constraints when there's no constraints is a really hard problem. So I don't know if I mischaracterized that, but some of you are in TUI, right? I mean, was it obvious where to start in that class? And that was part of the problem, was what do I do, right?
Yeah, we had several sort of design brainstorming, what should we start with,
but it was sometimes a lot harder to know where to start when there were no constraints than when there's a lot of constraints. And so again, the techniques you use to decide, I mean, it may be very iterative. You may just try a whole bunch of things and see which one sticks because there aren't any constraints. Again, I guess the best thing about that is that there's not any pressure to get it right, because that may be, in fact, the mandate of your organization to try a lot of things if you're in new product development. It's a little bit more difficult when you've got the clock is ticking in the class to spend the first 6 weeks figuring, what am I going to do? And again, it's been sort of fun to watch that upstairs. But so again, that's one aspect in which this design context shapes where you are. There's also a kind of way in which the architecture of your system or ecosystem will shape this. I mean, we talked at the third lecture about organizational context. And again, if you're in a highly regulated context like the government situation, if you're working for a government, military system design, or you're working in a situation like pharmaceuticals, you'll have a very highly regulated design problem, and you'll have to follow a waterfall model, or should we say a very coarse-grained iteration model, because having traceability and accountability are very important meta goals of the project. You want to be able to say, where are you? How did you get here? Why are you here? Kind of things. And that's hard to do if you have very rapid iteration. Related to that is, in fact, many of those situations do involve an external customer. We have a contract. There may be a very intense and often highly iterative phase at the beginning where you get the customer requirements right. And that, again, that may require a number of cycles of RFIs and RFPs and negotiations, and finally you have a specification, the statement of work. I mean, even think about that concept. What is the statement of work on the project you just had? Well, it evolved over time. And if you're building something under a government contract, maybe you have a very explicit statement of work, and it takes a long time to get to. But once it's in place, you have very little iteration, because iteration is seen as a change in a requirement, And often the contracts make that a very difficult to do on purpose. So some of you have, I mean, Jonah's shaking her head. She knows very well why it's important or why it's conventional for the kinds of very, make it very difficult to change the specification in a project like this. So, who has worked in a situation where you have things like change control boards or review boards or contract? I mean, some of you. What's it like in that environment?
Very process, but
there's maybe just. Well, give us more context. What was the situation?
Updating systems that were required to remain compliant with Sarbanes-Oxley.
Okay, so you're doing accounting systems.
Yeah.
Systems that have accounting implications. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we had this process to make sure that everything about projects, that we had a back out plan so we could get back to this pre-project state if we weren't going to get to the objective of the project.
Okay.
And also assess the risk that was at play during execution of the project. And there were multiple parties that had a stake in this, so everyone had to sign off on these changes and make sure that
Who decided what changes were going to be done?
Well, it was a board.
A board.
Change control.
And they met when? They met like once a week, once a month, once a quarter? Okay. But it was a very formal process. We're going to consider the following proposed change requests. And you turned a bunch of them down, didn't you?
Some were turned down.
Yeah.
And some of smaller scope were required less input from at a board level. So one person in that board had to say, well, I
So how do you, I mean, you did some of this in your project. You had a change control board that met once. And it said, Moscow. Right? And it said, some of these things we're going to not do. We're going to never come back and talk about them again. And that's a way to, in some sense, put some impedance in your project against iteration and revisiting design decisions. It's really important to have that, even at a project of the scale of yours, because it's easy to have a new member of a project team or a new stakeholder emerge and say, well, what about this? And you want to be able to say, we explicitly consider that and it's been ruled out of scope until the next version or the next coarse-grained iteration. That's really important. Now, again, there's the opposite situation, where maybe you're in kind of a mass market or off-the-shelf context where instead of having a explicit contracted specification to build something for a known customer, you're saying, we don't know who our customers are. Our challenge is to find something which will succeed in the marketplace. In that situation, you want to be able to use market feedback to adapt your product. You want to be able to do it quickly. And ideally, you'll be able to have a steady stream of modified or enhanced offerings as you're trying to meet exactly what the market wants. That is particularly the case where you have the nature of your service is such that you don't have to do a lot of customer connected work to make changes. So if you have shipped software to your customer and installed it in the customer's location, you can't say, oh, by the way, we want to change it. By the way, we want to change it. By the way, we want to change it. Because you won't either have access or the customer won't want to change their way of doing business to accommodate your changes. You may plan, we'll have releases every 6 months or whatever it is. Maybe an emergency bug fix might come, but that will cause some difficulty with the relationship. If you have a hosted application where the customer is just using your service, then you can change the underlying implementation of that service without any customer involvement at all. And that will strongly encourage a more iterative development methodology. So again, you see that these different kinds of contexts will shape the way you think about iteration in your project. Let's talk about the iteration cycle. So again, the By definition, iteration means that you want to build something, get feedback on it, learn from the feedback, and then revise what you built or build something else. And how much you spend on each of those activities is an important project management decision that you have to make. And it reflects all the things we just talked about the nature of the customer, the nature of the organization, the nature of the competitive landscape. All those things will shape that. And we could look at that and say, well, are you doing following a good practice or a good pattern with respect to that situation, or are you doing not so good? And so again, that's what the failing will shape is about whether your rework is good, bad, or ugly. Is it sort of planned? Is it unnecessary, or is it just plain stupid? And they have a lot of wonderful examples in that paper. So let's look at this idea of cycle time more precisely. The key questions are, what determines how long you should take on a cycle? And what you're building on each cycle. This, again, is very much related to the thing we talked about last time in prototyping. You're saying, what kind of design artifact am I going to produce this cycle in order to get the relevant feedback for this cycle? So just as we talked last time about how sometimes you need to be testing more front-end kind of capability, or sometimes you need to test more back-end capability. Maybe it's the form factor versus the functionality. You know, different kinds of cycles, different cycles that will build different things. That seems obvious, and yet if you're not sort of planning that, you may get yourself in a rut of always trying to solve the problem in the same way by throwing more code at something, they say. That may not be the right way to do the cycle. And some of that will be shaped by how you're building the design artifact during that cycle. We talked a few weeks ago when we talked about multiple devices and multiple platforms, about the idea of a model-based application where you build a more abstract, which you then can generate or configure or customize for a particular implementation. If you have if you're really testing a model, it might be a lot easier to realize that model in a testable artifact each cycle than if you're trying to build each one as a new thing. So again, you might be building it by hand, might take less time initially, but it might make your cycle times longer because you have to fix more things to get to the next level of functionality. Whereas if you have a model or a platform that you're adding onto, you may have to just change one small part of it to create the artifact needed for that cycle. And you have the question of how are you going to get feedback about the design artifact? Are you going to get it explicitly by doing some kind of test or measurement in some formal way? It could be in a laboratory, it could be a survey, it could be some kind of explicit interaction with the user, customer, stakeholder, whoever you are viewed as the person most able to give you feedback that cycle. Or it could be done implicitly. How do you get implicit feedback about a design? What do you look at? You just look at usage logs, for example. Look at usage records. That could be, again, looking at formal usage records, like looking at the logs on a website, web analytic kind of thing. What did people look at? How long do they spend looking at things? Or you can look at more, even more sort of implicit things like where marks. Did they take it out of the box? Which part of it did they use? You know, did it get dirty? Right? That kind of, things as simple as that would tell you a lot about whether it was used and how it was used, and that would give you feedback on the whether it met its intended purpose. And we'll talk a bit later on when we get to the idea of continuous alignment about the notion of a feedback dialogue, how to ensure that you have an ongoing conversation with your stakeholders to get feedback over the lifetime of your project. And the way in which that happens will change over the project. And finally, how will you evaluate the feedback and incorporate it into the next cycle? I mean, this is the hard part because in some sense that is design. I'm saying, I learned something, what do I do about it? It might mean I need another design because what I'm doing now isn't working. I mean, so it comes down to how do you measure, how do you evaluate how your current design or artifact did? Well, that means you're doing testing in some way. Usability testing or some other objective testing. And those criteria had better be objective. And you, some kind of usability target perhaps, or some kind of functional capability. Can I do X, Y, and Z with this, with the current level of capability? And then you have to decide, how will I incorporate what I just learned in the next version? Now, maybe that you don't. Maybe you're saying, we learned this, but we can't afford, given our resource or time or whatever it is, to do anything about it for this thing. We have to ship this product as it. But now we know something about the product we didn't know before. And a really important dimension here is the organizational culture or norms about learning from, I might say, failure or even just negative information. If you have a design artifact and you find that it has some bugs in it, okay, or that it doesn't meet some usability goal, or it has somehow doesn't satisfy your expectation about how what the quality of that or functionality of that service or system would be at this moment in this design lifetime, how do you feel about that? And in some organizational cultures, it's a really, really bad thing. You have missed your schedule. You have, you know, failed to meet your quality targets. And that is a really bad thing. In other organizations, it might be viewed as, great, we learned something really important about our product or service offering. Now, some of you have been in these kind of organizations. You were sitting knocking your head there. Were you in the former kind of organization where a failure was a really bad thing? It was viewed as negative? Learning something about your product that didn't work, was that a negative thing?
Well, actually, I was just remembering the lecture that you did on the manual sound on it, so that was recent, and that was
yes.
I was thinking that
having a little way. Well, again, you have to make sure, is your feedback objective? Are you getting good feedback? And that may be, maybe that's sort of a special case here about how are you sure you're getting accurate feedback? Some of you in Morton Hansen's class, I know he talked a bit about the Challenger disaster. You had to do that earlier in the semester, the role-playing thing. That's a relevant example. Does anyone want to revisit that example for us in the context of what I was just talking about?
So the people like Marion who are not in Morton's class would have the benefit of this wonderful example. Who's in Morton's class? You're in Morton's class. Yeah, sure.
Okay. So we talked about the... it was the Shelter disaster from 03?
Yeah, the one that blew up on the pad.
The one that blew up
because the O-ring, yeah.
It was coming back.
Oh, the tiles. It's the tiles. Okay.
It was the foam strike. But okay. It was actually the things that we were talking about sort of were based on this sort of culture in NASA of like, no, we know best, we know we're the engineers, we can get through anything, like we got a Apollo 13 home, we can totally do this.
Right.
And so if you maybe had doubts about something, you weren't necessarily really encouraged to speak, to really speak.
Right. The engineers who had done the design work said, we're not so sure that this stuff... This design will last given that some of the tiles have fallen off. But if we say that, we're going to take the fall for this mission. And we don't want to do that because that's considered very bad in the culture. So they let the thing fly up knowing that it had problems and it blew up on the way back in. I mean, what's the consequences of missing the release date in your company culture? You know, you're trying to ship some software and you go, we missed the target is this date. We have to slip the schedule. I mean, that could be really bad in some company cultures. I know Larry Ellison doesn't like that very much at Oracle. Anyone have any experience with that kind of thing in a... Yeah?
I know for contracts, you can either lose a contract or things fine, but you can fine for it.
You can fine for missing a day. So what typically happens there is the contractor will basically submit something they know doesn't work and hope that somebody else takes the fall for it. We used to call that... I'm trying to remember. We called it schedule roulette, I think. That's what it was called. Schedule roulette. You know, there's a game of Russian roulette, right? You know, where you have one bullet and it spins around and take turns putting it to your head and see if you blow your head off. You've seen this game, right? Okay, like in The Deer Hunter and stuff, that movie. So, suppose you have five different design teams on some really complicated project, and every one of you knows that your stuff doesn't quite work. Okay? But it's going to be, on December 1st, tomorrow, we got to decide whether we're going to ship this thing or not. So we have a meeting tonight, today, come up to the general or the vice president's office and say, he says, okay, we're ready to go? And of course, everyone's thinking, I'm not sure I'm ready to go, but if I say it first, then I'm taking the fall. Everyone else goes, well, we can't go because this stuff's not ready. And so they're all going on the table going, who should be the one that takes the fall for this? And if the culture is one that is penalizes excessively being telling the truth there, then the thing's going to fail, and maybe they won't be able to tell whose fault it was, and you won't learn the right lessons. So this is a really, really important idea about what's the culture around getting feedback, especially negative feedback. So I know that in Morton's class, you talk a lot about designing teams that can collaborate well and about that culture. Did I cover most of that stuff? I know he talked about this stuff extensively about how to ensure that a culture is one where it airs legitimate problems and sees them as things to learn from rather than things to punish people with. Now, if you've done a design that's built around, say, small units of functionality like use case, it's a very nice way to manage your implementation because you can simply use use case as the granularity. We use, let's just build this package of functionality and then go on to the next one. You simply follow the priority of use cases. So if you've done a good job of Moscovization, you can say, let's build the M's first and then the S's and so on. And it gives you a design methodology that looks like this, where you have an incremental build, where you basically partition your design into these use cases, and you build each feature set in this kind of iteration like this, and you see that there's this boomp, 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 and so on, until you've added all the features. But this shows that, in fact, iteration and building, of course, is going to reflect iteration and design. So you really have to have a consistent philosophy there. How are we going to go about doing this? You can't just sort of change your mind in the middle of your project to have a more granular iteration if you haven't designed it that way. It's just not going to be possible. It's not going to make any sense. But there's a real problem if you have a very small cycle and scope at each iteration. This is one that many of you have probably experienced, maybe even in your own projects here. And this is called scope creep. I think this comes because if you have a very small cycle, only a small number of things can be done in each cycle. Which means that people can easily say, well, here's a very small change. It can't take very long because, you know, it's a small change. So they're not going to propose big things. They know you only have, a small cycle time. And if a stakeholder proposes a small change, they often think that the designers or developers are being inflexible that they don't just do it because it's only a small change. This is especially a problem with user interface changes because, you know, people think that any software product is infinitely malleable because, hey, software, unlike, say, hardware, can be made to do anything. So there's this kind of illusion that says because software is this infinitely malleable medium in principle, at any given cycle it should be infinitely malleable to add one more feature. So if your client says, what about doing this? Move this to here or add this feature. And you say, I can't do that. They'll say, why are you being so stubborn? Have anybody ever experienced that? You've never experienced this? Gee, I guess I'm confessing my own. Yes.
But really, you just push a project off to the side.
Right. And one problem there is that sometimes what looks like a small change from a user interface standpoint is profoundly big from an architectural standpoint. We'll talk a little bit about this in the next lecture. We have a reading by, let me look at the guys' names, by Fulmer and Bosch about architectural implications for usability. Wonderful paper that says, you need to understand that some things that look simple in user land are very difficult in software architecture land. And the best example of that is the simple feature of undo. Okay? Like back up one step, undo. Seems like an easy thing to build, right? Just go backwards one thing. It could involve massive work from an architectural standpoint to be able to maintain all the state needed to back up what looks like one little step. And so, if you say, well, I'll just add a little backup feature. The web has, you know, backup button. You know, but it could be a bigger deal in your functionality than your users appreciate. So if you try to be helpful, say, well, okay, we'll add some of those little features to you because you're really complaining about them. You end up with this, lots of small iterations can be a big iteration, can be a big change. And you end up with a project which has been distracted by the planned work and is now off schedule because it has been distracted by all these tiny small implementations that didn't really mean very much in isolation, but together they make a massive redesign. Yeah.
The first
thing is
so frequently from the project
sponsor. That is right.
Very challenging
work. That's right. So how many times have you heard people say, again, I've said this many times. Your client says, well, how far along are we? You say, well, we're 90% done. Okay? And that can be 90% done on your schedule, but again, unless they have a really good model of what that means in terms of the effort or in terms of underlying functionality on a platform level, it could be a very long way in terms of what they want to see on the project. And so, scope creep can happen where there's a mismatch between people's view of how much progress has been done. Because sometimes you may be doing a lot of invisible work, and the client goes, well, you haven't even started yet, so we can change the requirements because you haven't started yet, and yet you've done all the work that's needed to build the functionality, even though it's not visible yet in an artifact that the sponsor can see. So how do you prevent scope creep? Joan? You say, we could do that, but it will cost you. That's the bottom. Remember that line. Can you do this? Of course we did it, but it will cost you. We'll let you know how much it's going to cost you when we get back to you next time. That always slows down scope creep. But again, it really comes down to having a clear view of what you want to do and its priorities. So Moscow, 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 both for you and as you've communicated with your customers or stakeholders. A disciplined way of getting responding to feedback so you can see whether in fact you are making the progress you need to make. And a kind of continuous management of expectation with your customer. And that's again, we'll talk more about that in a minute, about continuous stakeholder alignment issues. Now another thing you need to understand when you think about iteration abstractly is the problem of local optimization. If you have a very small cycle time, you're doing a small amount of functionality each time you do a cycle, you're often in the mode where you're saying, oh, we have to fix this bug we discovered in the last cycle, and then we're going to move on a little bit. But essentially, you may have a very narrow focus of redesign to fix some particular problem. And what that does is focuses... This is not a technical term, but it focuses all your rethinking in a very small neighborhood of the design space. So you're saying, I've got this project, I've got my design here, and I find this bug, so I've got to sort of fix it by tweaking something that's pretty close to what I'm doing now. And if you do that, then it says, I won't consider some radical new solution which can maybe make things a whole lot better. You sort of get yourself in the mode of looking only at small fixes in a neighborhood which have now small changes. And that means that you're never going to get any better than the locally optimal solution. If you make 100 iterations, you're sort of stuck in one part of the design space. Which means that
where you started from was really critical, even if it didn't seem so at the time. So if you pick the starting place almost at random or because you thought it was unconstrained, if you start making small changes, you may get stuck in that corner of the design space and not be able to find a better solution. Let me draw you some more technical pictures. So here's this idea that I have some, there's a point in the design space represented by the center of that circle, and there's some area around it that I'm able to look at in any iteration, let's say. And so I kind of make a change, make a change, make a change, make a change, and I can only make a small change each time. So if I'm only looking at nearby alternatives, I'm not going to find the best possible solution. I mean, another way to think about this is that you're in some space, design space, with lots of really good solutions, but you have to be in the neighborhood of an okay one. So you want to get to this place right here, the best possible solution, but you're on this hill. And so you might be working your way up this hill, and you're doing what in optimization, in mathematical optimization or economic optimization would be called a gradient method. You're moving up a hill or down a hill according to some objective function of quality. I want to make this solution better, so I'm moving. As long as it gets better, I'm going to move in this direction. But so you're thinking of it, moving up a slope or down a slope. This is basically differential equations and some things like that. Imagine moving up and down. You know this stuff, Ayush, right? Some gradient methods. Local maximum and local minimum, right. So we're going to find the local maximum here. The best solution in our neighborhood. But the problem is, it's really relatively poor compared to this hill and another hill, but you can't get there because you're never going to go down this hill to find it because that will look worse in the short term. So if we're looking at only locally optimal solutions, we can't find the best solution in our design space. So how do you solve that problem? Well, you solve it by having a design approach which finds more than one starting point, or that makes longer and more random movements in design space when you do it each iteration. So you've done this, by the way. When we started our project, I asked you to do a literature review, a competitive analysis, and a technology review, the point of which was to say, should we look at your problem from a lot of different points of view, which might be in different parts of the design space. So this might be where the literature is, this might be where the technology, this might be where your competitors are. And then you look at this and say, well, what's a good place to start? You have the benefit of looking at more than one place. That might give you an insight about what a higher likelihood of success point might be in the design space. Yes? Sure.
So depending on where you start on the smaller hill, on the side of the hill, I'm
trying to analogy. Yeah.
But if you start on the side that's closer to the big hill, and then you go back up to the smaller hill, the stuff you're doing is actually taking you farther away from reaching.
Yeah.
The bigger one. But if you start on the other side, it could be that what you're doing is taking you closer to the big one. I guess the analogy I'm trying to make is that sometimes in projects I've done, there's a deliverable, immediate deliverable that they want just to make them happy.
Yeah.
But to get there, do you do things that are going to prepare you for the longer term deliverable or make it harder to get
there? This is a really good question. And this is why, in terms of, and let's see if I can remember the term. I did a course in this stuff about 1974. So I'm not sure I remember the word on it. But there's a concept. I can't think of it. Is simulated annealing? That doesn't sound right. Maybe it is right. The idea is that it came out of my head 30 years later. That's pretty amazing. Okay. So the idea is you're wandering up this hill, and the numbers say you're getting better, 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 better. You just point out, you say, okay, it looks like I'm in the best place. I can't get any better. So what do you do? Well, we can either say we're done, we can declare victory and say we're done, or we can say, you know what? Let's roll the dice and just scramble things really and start over someplace else and then run the simulation again or run the optimization again and see if you ended up on a different hill. It's like you sort of violently disrupt the solution that you've got and see if you can start someplace else in the design space. That's easy to do mathematically when you're building something, okay?
But the idea, I think, is to get A's point. You're saying we did something. We had to build some kind of prototype as an early sign to the customer that we know what we're doing. But if we're not thinking about it, we end up building which is going to get us on the wrong hill. So let's find ways to keep our options open that we can jump to another starting point. And that's why, again, this. I didn't want to show you this picture at the time, but this was in my head when I said, go do literature review, technology possibilities. Pev now is saying, I want you to have different points of view on your design space. You wouldn't just say, well, let's just start building what the customers are doing or the competitors are doing or whatever. To give you a broader view of what's possible in your design space. Yeah.
There's one follow-up. If you're a consultant working for somebody else or providing to somebody else, you might not want to tell them about the bigger hill until you finish the smaller hill, because then you can say, oh, but you can hire us for this bigger hill, but don't tell them until you've already finished the first hill.
Well, that strikes me as slightly unethical to say, I'm going to sell you a bad solution knowing that there's a better one I can sell you if you pay me more.
It's not necessarily a bad solution. It's the best local solution.
Let's have a vote here. Who thinks that that's a sleazy way to do business?
Who thinks people actually do business that way?
Oh, well, that's a different question, Abe. I mean, again, of course there's a better. You can always say, I can sell you the Mercedes-Benz version, or I can sell you the Yugo version, or the General Motors version. You can provide a different set of alternatives at the beginning and say, which one do you want to pursue? Okay? But I think it's wrong to withhold what you know is a better solution. You want to put that in your bid and say there's multiple choices here. Make a choice. Then the customer is doing an informed decision as opposed to being duped, saying, well, why didn't you give me the better alternative at the beginning? I would have paid for that.
So what if you didn't know about that, but you discovered it happened?
Oh, that's great. You say, look, we learned something great. Let me tell you, I have this new idea. We just found something, a breakthrough. You can have, because of course, if it's hard for you to figure out, maybe your competitors don't know it either. So see, this may be the big breakthrough that gives you competitive advantage for a long time over your everyone else in the marketplace. That's a great way to sell it. Great way to sell it. This is good stuff. This is great. Again, this. I paid to use these pictures last year for the first time because I thought that it was hard to explain this idea of local optimization. But in fact, it's a really rich picture. I like that. So could you make a note to me, please, about this that says, you know, spend more time with it, because I think there's a lot of depth here that we haven't exploited. That's exactly what it is. This says, we see what we're doing, we can just sort of, you know, keep going on the path we're on and make it progressively better in a narrow scope, a low risk but narrow scope. This says, you know, if we're really lucky, we can find a really great solution here, but we have to take some more risks. It might mean doing a number of different projects in parallel that start at different places. And again, even things as simple as a step, think of the step size. Let's go back to this now. Suppose you start right here. Okay? If the step is very small, you're going to kind of crawl up one way. And if it's big, you might end up crawling the other way. This is like this sort of the butterfly effect, that some very small point, very small, almost random act could somehow shift you radically in the solution space. Because at this point, you're kind of indifferent. But one step in one direction, the other one randomly could end up making a very different end state. Wow, deep stuff. Now, I'm going to draw a simpler picture at a different granularity and that says, let's try this instead. So this really says, I have a concept, and I'm going to explicitly try to do these different, maybe have different design teams try something out, different initial ideas. And then merge and say, okay, let's see what the best things of this particular set of experiments has been, and then start that. And that's, again, I tried to do that this semester where I said, you know, do your experiments, do your different analyses, and then come back and give me a merged view of where you are now. What is the best new starting point given what you've just done in the first phase? So again, would these pictures have been helpful to show you back then in September? What I was trying to do for you? Or was it too meta? Maybe it's too meta now. But this is what I was trying to do for you back when I said, go study technology, go study competitors, go study, you know, the domain literature. I wanted you to try different things out and then see what's a better starting point than just starting at one of them. Would this have helped? This picture.
So this idea is that I want to generate lots of possibilities, and the question is, where do they come from? You know, where do these different versions come from, possibly? And this is why I wish I had time, but I decided not to take the lecture next week on design patterns, because the design patterns is one way of thinking about this. It's say, if there's a more abstract way to think about the design space, it will generate for us a number of possibilities which we can then explore in that parallel effort. So remember this paper, Aptian Mason. There's three kinds of things in an interaction. There's information exchanges, there's interpersonal exchanges, and there's physical actions. We can change the mix of those things. Or this particular paper about that things have production, consumption, distribution components, and they can be done together or differently in space and time. This is sort of a set of 25 different designs. Okay? Where you can say, these are 25 different ways of solving this problem. Should we solve the problem of education by having the professor, the student in the same room and having them work together collaboratively in real time? Or should we let the professor write his lectures, post them, and have the students play them at any point they want in the next 6 months? That's this one and that's this one. So it's the same solution space, but 25 different ways of thinking about the solution. And this is, again, a systematic framework for generating design ideas. And so that's, again, something which we could spend more time on. If this is an interesting stuff to you, you should try to find time to read chapter 10 of my book, because it's all about designing with patterns. And that's sort of what we talk about in that chapter. Now let's move on to this idea of the meta model for feedback. Again, this is the question is, well, we've got a cycle which defines a feedback activity, but how do we get it? Who do we get it from? And what do we do about it? And this is, again, the point of the chapter 5 I had you read in OISD, where they talk about the need for continuous stakeholder alignment. And this is a really, really important lesson. Because no matter how much you think you have it figured out when you start the project, both you change your view of things as you do your design, your customers, as they see your design and they learn new things, change their view, and the world may change just out from under you. And so there's a need to continuously monitor the relationship between you and your customers on sort of what you're trying to do. And that's this idea of continuous alignment. So this picture that you remember in this chapter shows the perspective of the stakeholder and the development team, and are they in alignment or have they changed? It could be that the development team just isn't tracking very well what the customers really want. The customers' goals have changed and the developers aren't following. Or the stakeholders haven't changed, but the developers have gotten new ideas because maybe new technologies come along or whatever it is, and they're now thinking something else that they weren't thinking when they first started talking. Or they both could have changed. In any case, there's a mismatch now between what the developer thinks is going on and what the customer thinks is going on, and that's not a good idea. So they go through a nice timeline of this process, saying you have to basically get aligned at the beginning. That's when you decide what to do. And then you have to basically plan to stay aligned. And that requires collecting feedback, evaluating it, and responding to it, and then communicating to your customers how you responded to the feedback. That's extremely important. It's almost worse to respond to feedback and not tell your customer than it is not to respond at all, than it is not to respond to feedback at all. Because in both cases, their expectations are not being managed well. So the goal is to treat the project as a continuous process of increasing your alignment with your customers and your stakeholders, so that by the time you actually get ready to release your product or service, you're in complete alignment. So you've used the design activity to increase the alignment. Because here that you have, maybe only have fairly vague goals, and this is yet to say, well, let me come up with a design which will meet your goals, and as you get better at that, you're going to close that gap. This might remind you of some of the things about service quality and the expectation gaps and things like that. There's a number of ways in which you could have this gap. We'll revisit some of that on Wednesday. But again, the goal is to get to the point where you're done when you agree on what you should have done and you've not done it. Because if you haven't, then you have a gap between expectations and what the reality was. But there's a caution here. And that is that, we have here the stakeholder, but the stakeholder may change during the project as part of this iteration. So it may be that you have some change in the scope of the project, which might bring some stakeholders in who are now out, or push them out who are first in, or otherwise raise the priority of some of those who were kind of on the fringe. A really good example of that might be an application where you designed it for some internal use by some known set of users, and all of a sudden someone says, we could use this for our customers or for this set of clients because we could sell it to somebody else that we haven't planned on selling it to. All of a sudden, their concerns become part of your design space. A good example might be if you decide that we should take this thing open source. Maybe we should decide that, now that would change again who the stakeholders are. You have to now manage a whole different set of expectations and customers that you didn't have to before. So there's an iteration here in priority scope and stakeholder identification, which again could bite you. Some of you might have found that this is Stephanie's project. Stephanie, AWOL. Yep, she's AWOL today. Make a note. If you remember, she said last time that they thought they were going to build a solution for the end user customers of household energy management and other kind of, the sort of smart home stuff. They decided over time that they're going to build something for the developers of those systems. A significant shift in the stakeholder, and of course it will change a great deal who you talk to and how you talk to them. They're going to ask different questions of the developer than you would of customers. And I'm sure this has been a major, major issue in the project. Is that right, Heather? The shift in stakeholder over time. So you need to plan to get feedback, and again, the trouble there is that you want to get feedback on everything you're doing, but that's not equally easy to do. It's not easy to get feedback on some parts of your project or solution than on others. It's easy to get feedback on things like features and usability. You put something in front of them and let them use it. But it's much harder to get feedback on things like installability, trainability, documentation, like some of the consumability things which you talked about a few weeks ago about can you actually take this out of the box and use it? Out of the box meaning metaphor. Can you use it directly? Well, how close are you to getting value when you give this thing to the customer? And some of those deployment and consumability things are hard to test until you do it, give it to the customer. So that could be a concern. You need to build the capacity to respond to the feedback you're going to get. And then build time to respond to that feedback. This again is tricky because, just as we talked about prototyping the other day, you need to have different kinds of prototypes at different points in your project and for different kinds of stakeholders to get different kinds of feedback. You don't show the CEO the same thing you show an engineer. You don't show your project sponsor the same thing you show an engineer. They don't want to see, code. They want to see, value. So you need to basically engage in a dialogue, and the key question there you want to ask yourself is, what is the minimal amount of thing I need to do to show my stakeholders to get useful feedback? If I give them too much, it overwhelms them, and the time it takes to give me feedback may in fact be a major portion of my cycle. If I give them too little, they'll go, this is all you have to show me for this whole bunch of work I've been paying for? So there's a sort of you're smiling, Joan, but again, this is a very subtle balance between what you show to get feedback and how much work you did to get that feedback. You don't want to overbuild the prototype if you only want to get feedback on some part of it. And this is part of the lessons last week about the anatomy of prototypes. Only prototype on those manifestations that you need to get feedback on. And finally, there's a wonderful picture in that chapter this one here about getting feedback. And basically, this is, it makes an obvious point that ties a lot of things together. It says, you get the most reliable feedback when you give an actual stakeholder an actual thing, an actual work product. But of course, that may not be possible or smart. Why build the entire thing to get feedback on some portion of it? But if you give a surrogate artifact to a surrogate stakeholder, you're getting the worst kind of feedback. You're giving something which is not really the thing you want to deliver at the end to someone who's not really the person you're going to deliver it to, then you're not going to get feedback. So this picture shows, they call them proxies as the sort of substitute stakeholder. And they have these kinds of artifacts, surrogate artifacts versus actual artifacts. And if you look at this, it says, I want to give the actual deliverable artifact to the actual stakeholder. And then the stakeholder can give you feedback about the thing they're going to actually get at the end. Pretty good feedback. This says, I give something like a storyboard or something that's basically a very low fidelity kind of artifact to someone who is standing in for the stakeholder, like maybe a salesperson or an analyst. Not so good. So you basically see the trade-off here. You have to invest appropriately in the artifact to get the right feedback from the right person. But it may be, for example, a lot easier to ask your salesperson, would the customer like this, than to make the trip to visit the customer. And this should remind you of a slide we showed on Monday, the one about algorithmically based artifacts. Remember the one about, it said, if you have this magic thing you build for customers to show some functionality, it could be basically completely faked functionality. But if you're not careful, the customer will think you've finished it and give you feedback saying, God, you've solved my problem. This is great. Then when they get the actual thing, which does half of what you showed in the mock-up, they'll think that you failed them. And so again, this whole question of fidelity and the appropriate prototype is extremely important. And finally, this picture about responding to feedback in the paper should really give you this. Again, it looks very much like the service quality framework about expectations and reality. It says we have the team's perspective and the stakeholder's perspective. What's the difference between those two perspectives? How do we resolve the fact that we've done something which the stakeholder doesn't like? The capability is not, I mean, the functionality or whatever the ility of the artifact you're giving, getting feedback on, isn't what the customer wanted or expected. What do you do? Well, we need to add capability to respond to this, or we need to modify our expectation of what we're going to build in order to be able to satisfy what we did. And then we need to incorporate that feedback. Then we need to tell the customer what we did. And this is, again, where it gets difficult. If you have trained your organization to think that missing customer requirements or having to change the design because of some defect or bug or problem that the customer discovered, this will make it harder for your designers and employees to achieve that converging understanding of your customers. Likewise, if you tell people, we'd love to hear you. I mean, you're one of our favorite, your comments are important to us, and then you never answer the phone after you had them on hold all day long, okay? You don't really believe that. And then you say, oh, but that's great, but we can't do that because we only have a week to fix things. They say, well, why did you bother asking me if you can't fix what I'm telling you? So you need to have expectations set that you're saying, I'm going to ask for feedback on this cycle, and then I'm going to ask for feedback on things which we can't fix this cycle, but maybe fix in future cycles. So you want to basically train your stakeholders to give you feedback that you can use given the iteration model you've got in place for your project. And that is iteration. So let me go back real quickly and show some of the highlights of this lecture. Again, the point I want to make is that you have to design iteration. It's not something which kind of just comes along. You have to sit back and consciously say, how am I going to use this technique of iteration? What am I going to, what's the scope I'm going to apply it on? How fast am I going to do it? And how am I going to get feedback? And how am I going to use that feedback? You can think of this as at different levels in the project, at the activity level, like agile methods, a couple of the programmers in the corner, or at the methodology level, or at the project management or product management level, institutional level, saying over time, how do we deal with our customers, how to develop customer interaction capability, and so on. It's clear that there are some implications for how iteration can be done based on different design contexts. That will shape the granularity of iteration, the way feedback is handled, and so on. We talked a lot about the cycle time, about how long it can take, what should be in it, and how that is shaped by other techniques, like whether things are built in model-based ways or by hand, whether you collect the feedback automatically or through interventionist needs, like through the surveys or something like that. How do you evaluate the feedback, and how do you incorporate it in the next cycle? We warned against things like scope creep and local optimization. Now I'm going to fix this picture for next time, make a multiple version of this picture with more insights in it. And we talked about this idea that there's a meta model for the cycle, there's a meta model for the feedback. The question you need to answer, how to get feedback, who to get it from, what to get it about, and how to react to it. And this points to this need for continuous alignment, which is harder than it looks. And that's it. Now, debated this a long time, because I almost threw this assignment away, but I finally decided that I just didn't have enough sense of you as individuals rather than as members of teams. So by getting rid of the last couple of readings, lectures to read for, I should have freed up some time for you to do something else, and I'm going to have you do this take-home assignment. Essentially, you can take it as a short essay exam, although I'd rather not think of it that way. What we've done is I put... in the assignment section here, I posted six questions. I'd like you to write about a page each on four of them. 500 words in that ballpark, 300 to 500 words. And then you have until the 11th of December, which is almost 2 weeks, to write them. And the idea is simply that you demonstrate your mastery of some of the key concepts of the course. The first one has you distinguish between customer, user, actor, stakeholder, citizen from the perspective of a designer. Next one asks you to compare information-intensive and experience-intensive systems. The next one asks you to deal with traceability as a design requirement. Next one talks about the continuum between person-to-person and self-service. Next one asks you to deal with multiple process models for different purposes. So you write on four of those six. That'll give me a good sense of what you really learned in this class, independent of what you've shown in your team projects. And finally, for this last lecture, I want you just to read the stuff here that really looks interesting to you. There's a number of different papers here. If you don't know a lot about usability engineering, there's a nice survey paper. If you know a lot about usability engineering, but you want to understand more about software architecture implications, there's an architecture paper about how architecture shapes usability. There's a paper you should all read about service level agreements. And how I view that as a kind of interesting convergence with usability measurement, because if service level agreement is a concept that's evolved in IT services and outsourced services, but in fact it really says, can we measure the quality of our service and the quality of the outcomes of our service? And there's some convergence now with customer experience management techniques and like remote usability testing and web analytics, where those are coming together, and I want to talk about that a little bit. So that's what you can look at this paper and the SLA paper. And finally, the paper which is probably too long to read about, but it talks about this idea of service recovery and some interesting thinking about the key points you need to be aware of in your overall management of the customer experience with respect to value creation when things go wrong. And with